Every crisis needs a hero, and the moonshot to develop a vaccine against SARS-CoV-2 needed a few of those amid big egos, big money and political chaos. Unlikely allies came together to produce an effective vaccine in record time. Journalist Brendan Burrell goes behind the scenes of the race to create a COVID-19 vaccine. His book is called First Shots: The Epic Rivalries and Heroic Science Behind the Race to the Coronavirus Vaccine. The book has already been optioned for an HBO series. Brendan Burrell joins me now. Hi there.
Hey there. Glad to be here.
And actually, the first heroes arrived before this pandemic. They're the people toiling away in the labs years before we'd heard of COVID-19 because they saw the potential for something very scary, right? Who are those heroes?
Well, one of the heroes I write about is a fellow named Barney Graham, a virologist and vaccinologist who was working at the U.S. National Institutes of Health. And he sort of worked on these obscure viruses that nobody really cared about. Everybody was kind of focused on HIV, which is a very important disease. And he was looking at an obscure virus called the respiratory syncytial virus. And the discoveries he made from that virus basically set the stage for him to develop a coronavirus vaccine.
Yeah, and there's also Katalin Karikó, the Hungarian chemist, right?
Yes, she was a key player in developing the tools that we needed to get the RNA and the vaccines from Moderna and BioNTech, Pfizer, into human cells. Basically, she figured out a way to outwit our body's defense systems so that it would accept this foreign RNA that's used in the vaccines.
Can you explain to us what a dramatic innovation mRNA is?
Yeah, it had been kind of the dream for a long time. Most traditional vaccines, it's like you have to manufacture the protein. They call it the antigen in the vaccine business. This is the thing that your body sort of has to develop that antibody response to. And normally you have this complex genetic engineering, grow the thing up in a vat and a factory. And it's like this messy process to purify it and so on. Well, RNA, the idea was, rather than giving the body that protein, you give it just the instructions so that your own cells make the protein. You turn your cells into the factory. And the beauty of this is the manufacturing is always the same. So there aren't a bunch of kinks to work out. And that is sort of ideal for addressing a pandemic like this.
Last year, I spoke to Eddie Holmes, an Australian virologist, another one of the heroes, and he actually convinced Zhang Yongzhen in China to release the genetic code of the SARS virus. Now, that was actually a very brave thing to do. In fact, there's almost a Hollywood movie in that. Can you tell us that story?
Eddie is an amazing character, and yeah, I spoke to him for the book. He had this close relationship with Dr. Zhang, and you know, they've been studying viruses, these RNA viruses like SARS and the new coronavirus. You know, at the time in early January, Eddie had sort of seen the analysis of this gene sequence of this unknown virus, but he didn't actually have the sequence in his hands. The international community was clamoring for it. Eddie was getting calls from the UK, from colleagues in the US. And he gets Zhang on the phone one morning when Zhang's about to fly to Shanghai. And he's like, we've got to release the sequence. And finally, he concedes to do it. They upload it and it ricochets around the world. And that was kind of the start of the vaccine race.
And, you know, as I said, Zhang put himself at great risk. There was a lot of pressure in China to close up shop, right?
That's right. It was a huge blow to him. I mean, he kind of went under the radar for a couple of weeks after that. I was told, you know, that basically his lab was turned upside down, scrutinized, you know, but he has managed to sort of get in good and he's back to work. But it was a rough couple of weeks for him.
Here's another story worthy of Hollywood. An American physician who manages to get into Wuhan a day before it shuts down. How important was it to have eyes on the ground in those very early days of the outbreak?
I mean, we knew nothing. I mean, if you remember what it was like, it was just, we heard these patchy reports. there's a virus. What is it? You know, finally it leaks out that it's the coronavirus, but nobody knew how bad it was going to be. And most of these sort of emerging diseases, they sort of vanish before they cause too much trouble. In this case, the Chinese were not sharing a lot of information. Well, a doctor that I write about, Michael Callahan, who works here at Harvard's Massachusetts General Hospital, he had this long-term collaboration with the Chinese, with some Chinese scientists in Nanjing, and they got the countrywide call to go to Wuhan. So there, Michael is tapped into them, goes to the Wuhan Central Hospital, sees what's happening with these patients. He gets access to some of the sort of confidential data about how many patients were being monitored, how many were being tracked and traced, all of this in the early days of the pandemic. And he shares it with the US government.
Yeah. And around that point, the then President Donald Trump is telling Americans the virus is no big deal. What were his lieutenants doing behind the scenes?
It was so complicated, right? That there's a, I write a lot in the book about kind of what was going on behind the scenes in the Trump administration. I mean, on the surface, you know, there was scientific confusion about how bad the virus was going to be. And then just at the moment when we're starting to sort of get some unanimity where most scientists are like, this is going to be very bad, that is when members of the administration start to muzzle the public messaging. They start to stop this information from getting out. But a couple of folks sort of working behind the scenes were like, the only way out of this mess is the vaccines. And I write about Bob Kadlec, who's was a Trump appointee, but one of the architects of Operation Warp Speed, which was our program that accelerated vaccine development and manufacturing.
And credit where credit's due, right? Warp Speed was a huge success.
Absolutely. I mean, we poured billions of dollars into this effort, and I think the benefits clearly trickled down to other countries. I mean, it's kind of an irony of it, of course, is the former President Trump was very inwardly focused. He was opposed to he pulled out of the WHO and so on. He wouldn't let people collaborate in these international vaccine collaborations, yet this program that he funded ultimately has had some benefits for the global community.
And speaking of unlikely heroes, do we need to pay tribute to Jared Kushner as well, the president's son-in-law?
He is a complicated figure in all of this. You know, the way I describe him is, you know, he's a smart guy. There's no question. But it's a little bit complicated when you are the president's son-in-law. I mean, it's amazing to me to this day that such a thing can happen in the United States, that you can have family member with so much power. He's in the White House. But what does it do during a pandemic? Well, he has like the president's ear. Anybody who starts to work for him or report to him has an incredible amount of power. And it was Kushner who basically got Operation Warp Speed off the ground. So yes, we can thank him for doing that.
I'm talking to journalist Brendan Burrell. His book is called First Shots, The Epic Rivalries and Heroic Science Behind the Race to the Coronavirus Vaccine. Did the pharma companies take much convincing? I guess where there's money, there's action.
They actually did take some convincing, you know. These emerging diseases have kind of been thought of as losers for the pharma industry because, again, these outbreak breaks out somewhere in Africa or Asia, and it vanishes before you have anyone to test it on, anyone to sell it to. And the same was kind of thought of this new coronavirus in early January. The pharma companies like Merck and Sanofi, these are the biggest manufacturers in the world. They said, no, we're going to sit on the sidelines. It was really only sort of towards the middle of March that Pfizer threw its hat in the race and that Merck and Sanofi started ramping things up. So they did take a little bit of convincing. And with the funding from Warp Speed, they started moving a little bit faster than they might have otherwise.
And your title references heroes and villains. Do we sort those vaccine companies into those categories, or are they all sort of in the same boat?
You know, I think I try to be fair with everyone. You got, I mean, all the players in this vaccine story. You've got the companies, you've got the government, and within the government, we have, you know, the military scientists and the politicians. You know, they all have different motivations, and I try to unpack that because, listen, it's okay if a pharmaceutical company makes a profit, but when it's working in conjunction with the government, they have to keep them in check. They have to say, listen, this is for the good of America. We're going to pay you this much money, and you're going to give us this or do that. And so there's this constant tug of war. So I don't know if I would sort of characterize any of these groups as villains, but I would say their interests were just slightly misaligned. There are a few villains in the story, though, and people who tried to prevent, say, information from getting out about the coronavirus pandemic and its impact.
Yeah, if you're an anti-vaxxer and you're trying to smear the makers of the vaccines, it's not a tough job because a lot of these companies do have skeletons in their closet. Having investigated some of the not very nice characters behind some of these brands, are you at all concerned about the safety of the vaccines?
No, I mean, you're right. This was a moment where pharma could really shine, right? I mean, Pfizer has become a bit of a hero here in the US, but they have this history of sort of false advertising, getting in, you know, made major trouble with the government. But what happened during the pandemic was the best of the best working to solve this crisis as fast as possible. And having sort of seen the level of care that was taken in the sort of planning, the design, the developing and testing of these vaccines, and then the regulatory process here at the U.S. in the U.S. FDA, I think they did a great job in taking the right amount of caution to ensure that these things are safe. And now they've been hundreds of millions of people, billions of people, and we have the side effects have been very, very limited. So I absolutely trust these vaccines.
Your book was published too early for Omicron, of course, but was the emergence of a new variant predictable in the way the vaccine was created, fast and with profit as an incentive? If we put a price on the medicine, does that make it more likely that we'll have places that can't afford mass vaccination and that might create a hotbed for variants?
I think that one of the big letdowns of this pandemic has been the fact that the global rollouts of vaccines has not been successful. You know, the international collaboration failed because of kind of stinginess among the companies and the countries themselves. Africans, in many African countries, the vaccination rate is pitifully low. Even here in the Western Hemisphere, Haiti, I just looked up, 1% of the population has been vaccinated. That's crazy. And yes, that basically allows the virus to evolve unchecked and potentially spring up again. You know, you're right. I finished my book in January of 2021. So quite a while, the narrative ends. But my key scientists, they're trying to prepare for the next variant. At that time, we were talking about beta. Now it's Omicron. And I think that these threats will continue in the future. And we need to stamp this out with vaccines and treatments and all of that. And it's got to be a global effort.
What do you make of vaccine manufacturers patenting their inventions and perhaps not crediting the people quite early on without whom the vaccine would never have been invented? I'm thinking back to Barney Graham, who you mentioned.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that has been a real disappointment. You know, so Barney Graham, he worked at the National Institutes of Health, but had a close collaboration with Moderna. And without that collaboration, neither of those groups would have been able to get the vaccine developed and out the door as quickly as they did. And, you know, the folks at NIH, they really liked Moderna. So when they heard that, oh my God, this Moderna is going ahead and filing a patent without including the names of some of the key scientists who they believe deserve credit, that was definitely a problem. I mean, to be clear, companies, you know, the patent system serves a role. It incentivizes companies to invest in products and create new things that are going to help the world, but it can also be used as a weapon. And I mean, Moderna is, you know, this fortress of patents. That's how it protects itself. And I think they may have made a misstep here, both for, you know, in terms of what, how you should act during a pandemic. And in this case, I've talked to a few people about this. The patent that they've filed, it's not the only patent that the NIH has produced related to coronavirus vaccines. There's a chance that patent's not even that valuable. But yeah, I think that this is an important issue, and sharing of patents, getting this vaccine produced in other countries, is going to require breaking through this legal tangle.
We have the Pfizer vaccine here in New Zealand, although I think most New Zealanders would be surprised to hear that it was Pfizer that cost Donald Trump the election, according to him.
I've written on that a little bit. There's definitely some conspiracy theories among the ex-Trump officials. Everybody, you know, during the election season here, which was November 2020, it was happening right around the time we were all waiting for the clinical trial results to come out. And Pfizer had been promising they were going to have the results by October, maybe at the earliest. And then suddenly they hit the brakes. And so, yes, Trump consistently blamed Pfizer for causing him the election and attacked the company. But I think that their decision was based on the science. They saw that they needed to wait. The way the FDA rules were, it was going to make more sense to collect a little bit more data, and the speed at which cases rolled in. I mean, they came out of that process with a vaccine that was more than 90% effective. So they'd certainly made the right call.
It's been a good couple of years for science, I've got to say. Most people seem to appreciate that it's science and scientists that have gotten us out of this mess to a certain extent. But do we perhaps underestimate the value of good leadership as well as good science in this story?
I think so. That was one of the things I was sort of consistently impressed by. And you know, I'm a freelance journalist. I work alone. I'm not good at working on teams. But what I saw talking to all these people was the scientists, the folks in Warp Speed and the government. It was like leadership was critical. You need somebody who can kind of wrangle all of these scientists whose heads are in the clouds, who are thinking about the big questions, and get them to focus on your mission that's at hand. And you have to do that without bruising too many egos. So yeah, I think good leadership on I guess that's a managerial type of leadership. The other level of leadership is, of course, the political side. You know, the president sending mixed messages was a huge problem during the pandemic, and having one voice and a clear and consistent science-based policy would have been very helpful.
Here in New Zealand, it looks like around 5% of people will refuse the vaccine. That must be tremendously disheartening for the people who put their heart and souls into coming up with it. Is there anything we could have done differently from day zero to avoid having a section of the population that was suspicious of enough of the vaccine to not trust the people telling them to get it?
I don't think anybody was prepared for the level of anti-vaccine sentiment that we've experienced and that we've seen. We always knew there was a small fraction of the population that would refuse some of these vaccines. But yeah, this has been pretty shocking to me. You know, I think during the pandemic, there was a lot, you know, here in the U.S., it was a very heated atmosphere with the president attacking our regulators and so on. And that definitely contributed to some hesitancy early on. But now, I mean, I think we've seen these vaccines have been rolled out and they're safe. And the people who are resisting, it's a little bit hard to know what there is left to convince them. I think that the message just has to be consistent. Like, look, these things do not have major side effects. This is, you know, COVID is actually, even though it's not, you know, deadly in everybody, even though only a small fraction of people are hospitalized, it is still something that you don't want to get without being vaccinated. And especially with Omicron, we don't quite know how effective the vaccines are going to be against preventing hospitalization in Omicron, but they are very likely to help. Our immune system can learn from one pathogen, from one vaccine, and sort of adapt to whatever's coming next.
Congratulations on the book. It's been great fun chatting to you about it, and thanks so much for your time today. I've been interviewing journalist Brendan Burrell, and the book is called First Shots, The Epic Rivalries and Heroic Science Behind the Race to the Coronavirus Vaccine, and there are plenty more stories in that book as well. Thanks, Brendan.
Thanks for having me.